I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Michelle Robinson was a rising lawyer at a prestigious law firm, an American success story. She was raised in a one-bedroom apartment on Chicago's South Side by parents who pushed and prodded and made her believe there was nothing a young black woman couldn't do. When she met a young intern who had dreams of running for office, she embarked on a journey that ultimately took her to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, where Michelle Robinson Obama became the nation's first African-American First Lady and one of the most visible, active, admired, and criticized women to hold that demanding job, which, by the way, she's handled while raising two young daughters. Peter Slevin, former Washington Post reporter, has written a biography of the First Lady. He joins us next on Midday, right after the news. Welcome to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, in today for Dan Rodericks. To critics on the right, she is an angry black woman who spends too much time playing the victim card. Critics on the left say she spends too much time planting gardens and worrying about French fries when there are far more important issues at hand. To fashionistas, she is the best thing to happen to the White House since Jackie Kennedy. To millions of young women, white and black, she is a role model and a hero from a family that scraped by in a one-bedroom apartment on Chicago's South Side, a family that nevertheless convinced her there was nothing a young black woman couldn't do, and that meant navigating the elite world of Princeton University, earning a Harvard law degree, landing a job as a corporate attorney, and emerging as an activist for racial and economic equality. To her daughters, she was the mom who held things together while dad was on the road persuading people to vote for him. And no one doubts that Michelle Robinson was the best thing that ever happened to a young legal intern named Barack Obama, who caught her eye at a Chicago law firm. Michelle Obama's story is pretty unique in the annals of American politics. And Peter Slevin, a former Washington Post reporter who's covered Obama's 2008 campaign, has spent years documenting the political and social forces, as well as the people who shaped the nation's only African-American First Lady. He's chronicled the sacrifices she made, the unique partnership that she's forged with the president. Their marriage, he reports, has had its ups and downs, most of them involving what the president once called her competing visions of herself, the desire to be the dependable homemaker her mother had always been, and then, of course, the desire to excel in her profession, and the desire to make her mark in the world. And, well, there's no question that they are soulmates. Mr. Slevin says Michelle found Barack to be less domestically involved and less, as she put it, evolved than she had hoped. It's all here in this provocative new biography simply titled Michelle Obama, A Life. The author, Peter Slevin, is a veteran, a national and international journalist, first for the Miami Herald, then for the Washington Post. He's reported from Europe, Moscow, Cuba, Haiti, Washington, and elsewhere. He covered the Bush-Gore recount, the attacks of 9/11 and their aftermath, and eventually became the Post's Chicago bureau chief. That's where he wrote extensively about Barack and Michelle Obama as he covered the 2008 campaign. Mr. Slevin is currently an associate professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, and he's here today to talk about his new biography that he's written, Michelle Obama, A Life. And Peter Slevin, welcome here to the Baltimore airwaves, and welcome to Midday.
Thank you so much, Aaron.
So listen, Peter, this recent speech of Michelle Obama's was too late to make it into your book. I thought we'd begin here, though. Michelle Obama recently gave a commencement speech at Tuskegee Institute, which I suppose you probably caught this speech or caught wind of it. And this is a speech that really distilled a lot of the themes in your biography, and it generated a good bit of reaction from the right. I'm sure you followed this controversy. Talk about what her message was and how it was perceived.
It really did get a lot of attention, Aaron, when she spoke at Tuskegee University, bringing together her story, the story that she is sharing with so many audiences around the country these days, and also showing the ways in which she can be a lightning rod to the right. Her message was very straightforward. She says, life is still pretty hard for an awful lot of people in this country because, in particular, of race, also issues of poverty and class. She used the power of her own trajectory, as she often does, by telling stories from her own life, as well as stories from some of the more illustrious Tuskegee graduates. And she pointed out that while the deck is still stacked in many ways, while there's still an awful long way to go, one should never give up. One should never surrender to the critics, to what these days would be called the haters. And she showed that, she argued that just as she had climbed the ladder, so can many others.
Peter Slevin, that speech was a bit of a departure. I mean, Michelle Obama, as we understand her, has never really gotten directly involved in major policy issues, like in the way that Hillary Clinton did during Bill Clinton's first term. And yet, as you say, she is a lightning rod. The right loves to hate her. Why do you think that is?
I think it's partly a product of the times. Living in such a polarized country right now, politically polarized, some of it is attributable to her progressive politics. And it would probably be true of any first lady in the White House who had those politics. But it's unquestionable, too, that part of this has to do with race and the narrative about race in this country. I was able to show in the book how many examples there are of known, notable people, often Republican men, who criticized Michelle Obama in racial terms.
Right. And one of the things that made that recent speech at Tuskegee Institute really stand out is that she basically elaborated on that list of names herself in front of an audience to quite a reaction. Let me ask you, Peter Slevin, why you wrote this book and why now?
I think Michelle Obama merits a book where she is at the center of her own story. She's not just wife of the more famous Barack. Her trajectory is remarkable when you think, as you said in the opening, that she came from a working class background on the South Side of Chicago, propelled herself through Princeton and Harvard and into a very independent 20-year professional year in Chicago, career in Chicago. And I wanted to explore what it is she's saying in this role. What is she doing in this role in the White House as one of the most prominent women in the country, if not the world, and figure out where that is coming from, where those messages are coming from.
Peter, I want to ask you how you put this book together, how you compiled your information, because I should say, you know, Michelle Obama is at once a very open person, very, you know, always there with open arms to hug someone, but also a very private person. She did not directly grant you an interview for this book.
That's right. She was not made available to me while writing the book. I last interviewed her twice during the first presidential campaign. But the book itself was just great fun to work on. It was a real challenge. You know, I'd been a reporter, as you pointed out, for, gosh, 30 years for the Miami Herald and the Washington Post. And to have the chance to go back into her family history, into Chicago history, to talk to friends, to relatives, to mentors. I talked with her Princeton and Harvard friends and colleagues. I talked with people she worked with at the White House. It was just a great great privilege and in many ways just a very satisfying effort. And I, even though she did not grant me an interview, I also benefited from the luxury of time. I was at this for more than 4 years. And I poured over hundreds of thousands of words that Michelle Obama has spoken, searching for stories and themes and great, great nuggets.
One of the really unique windows into her life in this book is a window into her early years. I wonder if you might talk a little bit about her childhood home, life on the South Side of Chicago, and how that molded her as a person.
Yes, of course. Michelle Obama was born in 1964, the year that the Civil Rights Act was passed. She grew up in this working class household where her father worked for the city at the city water plant in Chicago. He was a precinct worker for the Democratic organization. Her mother stayed home, which was somewhat unusual, only going to work as a secretary when Michelle and her older brother, Craig, were in high school. It was a very close-knit family, a very large family of not just the parents, but the grandparents and many cousins and aunts and uncles. She said often that her role models were not astronauts or scientists or performers. They were people she knew, people she could touch, and she had so many role models around her in her neighborhood and in her family. And it's also, though, important to recognize what Chicago was like when she was growing up. It was a deeply segregated city where opportunity for African Americans was very, very limited. That too was an important part of her story.
Peter Slevin, what is that South Shore neighborhood like today?
It is still largely African American. You know, it's just south of the University of Chicago, which is a bit of a multiracial, multicultural oasis in the middle of Chicago. It's a working class, middle class neighborhood. In fact, some of Michelle's relatives, including her aunt Grace Hale, still live just right around the corner from the house that her mother still owns.
You report in your book that Michelle Robinson's brother, Craig, said that living in this home, this apartment, was like living in Shangri-La. What do you think was so special about that household?
That was one of the reasons that I wrote the book. We have this kind of two-dimensional idea of what it means to grow up as an African American girl in Chicago at this time. That the streets must have been rough, and everything must have been just terribly sort of tough day in and day out. In fact, Craig Robinson did say that it was a Shangri-La, and by that he meant that the family was very supportive, very warm. They walked to school, they could play outdoors, they would ride their bikes over to Lake Michigan, to Rainbow Beach. That was one particular destination. They took car rides as a family on Sundays, where Fraser Robinson, their father, would spin stories of history and the present day. And Mrs. Robinson, Marian Robinson, was there as a very embracing figure and very much part of their lives, not just at home, but at their school where she volunteered.
Peter, you mentioned Rainbow Beach. That was, if I remember correctly, that's one of the locales where Michelle Robinson had sort of her first encounter with the racial tension.
Rainbow Beach is an interesting place in Chicago and in Chicago's racial history. There were protests there in 1961 as white flight was beginning and the black population, which had been largely enclosed due to housing troubles in one part of the city, was expanding, and there was racial trouble there. By the early 70s, when Michelle and Craig were coming of age, they could ride their bikes there. Michelle went to camp there. She tells a story of being in camp. I don't know that there were racial overtones to this at all, but she was told when she was 10 years old that she was just about to be named best camper, but her counselor said, "Well, you can't be best camper because you have too salty a tongue."
It's ironic in a way, because I have a feeling that as our conversation progresses, we're really going to get into looking at how she has learned to hold her tongue in a lot of ways in the position that she has, been elevated to. I do need to pause us, though, Peter Slevin, as we get ready to take a quick break. You're tuned to Midday. This is Aaron Henkin in for Dan Rodericks. Our guest, Peter Slevin, he's written a biography, Michelle Obama, A Life. Your thoughts are welcome, 410-662-8780, and we'll be right back. You're tuned to Midday here on WYPR. Aaron Henkin in for Dan Rodericks. And listeners, we welcome your voice here in this conversation with Peter Slevin. He's the author of Michelle Obama, A Life. You can join us live on the air here at 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780. Or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. What are your thoughts about our First Lady, her path, her priorities, her accomplishments? Where has she excelled? Where has she fallen short? How much is she holding back? And what do you suppose might be next for her in the years after her husband's presidency? Your thoughts are welcome. 410-662-8780. 0. And Peter Slevin, let's move forward to Michelle Obama's, Michelle Robinson's time at Princeton University. Talk about what kind of a change went through her when she arrived at Princeton.
It was a very dramatic move for her. She was 17 years old in 1981 when she showed up on Princeton's campus. She'd been to a public magnet high school, and she'd done well. But it was a place, Princeton University at the time, that she found not particularly friendly to African Americans, where she felt very much an outsider, partly because of race, significantly because of race, but also because of class. She said she found kids who drove BMWs. She said, I didn't even know adults who drove BMWs. And she wrote rather famously now in her thesis as a sociology major at Princeton, that Princeton made me more aware of my blackness than I had ever been before.
And it's interesting when you really pick apart that idea of being aware of one's own blackness. That's, you know, seeing herself through, you know, the eyes of these white folks with BMWs, but also the questioning of who she was and whether she was, quote unquote, black enough. Right. Talk about what that meant.
I spoke with her advisors at Princeton and some of her friends at Princeton, who said that this was an internal conversation that Michelle and many other black students had at the time, to try to figure out where to fit in, where they did fit in, not just vis-a-vis white people, but also among black students who had many different ways of, as one faculty member put it, being black, whether one focused on a particularly sort of Afrocentric, very politicized way of thinking, whether one wanted to fit in more with white students. It was a very complicated, very fraught time.
Peter, let me have you rewind, actually, and talk a little bit about Michelle Obama, then Michelle Robinson's parents, where they're from and how they made their way to Chicago.
Well, it is important to think about who they were, and it does connect with her time at Princeton, because she later said that she really couldn't ask her parents to understand what was going on at Princeton because it was so far removed from their own experience. Fraser Robinson, her father, was born in 1935 on the south side of Chicago, her mother 2 years later. Her mother went to segregated schools on the south side. Neither of them finished college. Both said to their children that had been a big, big mistake. And they had a very sort of solid working class existence where they had great ambitions for their children, but it was unchanneled. It was unclear kind of what Michelle and Craig could do. And then it turned out that Craig turned out to be a pretty great basketball player, and he was recruited by Princeton. And got into Princeton. Coach Pete Carril was the coach, Hall of Fame coach, who recruited him. And Michelle said, well, gee, if Craig can get in, I can get in. I want to go there, too. Hmm.
And, you know, it's an interesting anecdote that you put into this book about the fact that when her brother Craig was accepted at Princeton, he was shy about accepting the invitation because it would have cost his folks more money. And he had a conversation with his dad about that.
That's right. They were in the kitchen of their small apartment on the south side. And Craig had a scholarship offer from the University of Washington, as well as an invitation, an acceptance from Princeton. And he told his father that he was thinking he'd go to Washington, that made an awful lot of sense for the family. And Fraser Robinson apparently stroked his chin and said, gee, Craig, I just don't know if you should be making a decision. I hope you wouldn't make a decision this important on the basis of money. And Craig was sort of told his father quietly that he would think about it overnight. But inside, he was just ebullient because he realized that he really could go to Princeton. His father was going to sign off on that. And he said it was the greatest act of generosity that he had experienced in his life. Later on, when Craig and Michelle were at Princeton, they recalled that their parents would pay their share of the tuition, sometimes by credit card, because they didn't have the cash on hand.
Hmm. How about Michelle's subsequent career at Harvard Law School? That was an educational environment that she felt more at home in.
That was a very important period in Michelle Obama's life. She went on to Harvard Law School after Princeton, in part, she said, because she wasn't really sure what else to do. But her ambitions had been growing. Her gaze had certainly expanded. And she got to Harvard in a really interesting time, Aaron, in 1985, when much of the talk on campus was about race. Reagan was in the White House. Clarence Thomas, you'll remember, was head of the EEOC. Affirmative action was in full flower with its supporters and its critics. And she found what one of her friends told me was a critical mass of African Americans who contemplated and discussed really important questions about what role they could play as lawyers, as Black lawyers. What was their responsibility to other African Americans? What brought change about? Was it the law? Was it legislation? Was it something entirely different? These were the kinds of questions that Michelle Robinson was asking.
And she was pursuing these sort of socially conscious ways of applying her legal skills at the same time.
Very much so. She worked for the Legal Aid Bureau, which was a group of law students, about 60 a year, who would work with indigent clients in Cambridge and Boston and other places nearby. She worked as a volunteer editor for something called the Black Letter Journal, which was a politically conscious alternative to the estimable Harvard Law Review that Barack Obama was led as the president of a few years later. And she worked also to increase sort of a social consciousness among her classmates as well.
Peter Slevin, help me understand then how Michelle Obama went from that setting and that focus to a first job after Harvard Law School at a corporate law firm. I don't remember the name of the law firm. What was it again?
Sure, it was in Chicago, a white shoe firm called Sidley and Austin. And it is a bit perplexing, isn't it, to think that she was so conscious of how she might make a difference, how she might give back, and yet she ends up in this pretty politically conservative institution doing corporate law, very far removed from issues that she cared about. She said that she wasn't quite sure when she got out of Harvard what she wanted to do. The money was attractive. She instantly was making more than her parents' salary combined, and she certainly had loans from Princeton and Harvard that she and Barack Obama were paying off until just a few years before the first presidential run. Very quickly, she soured on the firm and decided that, in fact, that wasn't the world where she felt most comfortable. But as you had pointed out in your intro, something interesting had happened along the way.
Yes, she did get one positive experience out of her time at that firm. Talk about that.
That's right. She met one Barack Obama. He was a first-year law student. Now Barack Obama is older than Michelle Obama, but you'll remember that he was a community organizer on the south side of Chicago for 3 years before he went to Harvard. And so he was at Harvard Law School after Michelle left. And Michelle was a first-year associate at the law firm. She was helping with recruiting, and the firm asked if she would keep an eye out for this hotshot from Harvard named Barack Obama.
She was his supervisor. He was her intern.
That's right. She was his mentor, I think you would put it.
Mentor.
When he showed up in the summer of 1989.
Tell me about what it was, how they hit it off. I mean, how did things develop from there, from them personally?
Well, she admitted that she was just at first a little skeptical about who this guy was and all the great things that so many people were saying about him. At one point, she said, "Well, of course. I mean, he's just a Black guy who can talk straight. So of course, everybody thought he was great." But she was pretty quickly impressed with him. She liked his sense of humor. She liked that he was different, not just from many of the other people who worked at Sidley and Austin, but his experience was so different from her own, and they started spending a lot of time together. But he wanted to date Michelle Obama at that time, Michelle Robinson. She was much more skeptical. She didn't think this was such a great idea, not least because here she had been placed in this position of responsibility for him by the firm, and she thought, well, it might just be a little bit tacky, if nothing else.
He was obviously very smitten by her. I mean, what do you think drew him to her?
He has described finding her smart and funny and gorgeous. he hit it off with her right from the start, he said.
And, you know, it's interesting to look at their two family backgrounds side by side because it seems like Michelle Robinson grew up having a lot of things in place that, you know, were sort of scattered to the four winds for Barack Obama.
Yes, that's exactly right, Aaron. And that was one of the appeals to one of the things he found very appealing about Michelle. And it was that sense that she was rooted in a place and a family and a culture. And he used that very expression that his own bloodlines had been scattered to the four winds. He had a mother from Kansas, a father from Kenya, who he barely knew. In fact, he only met him once the father left the family when Barack was very young. He only met him once more when he was 10 years old. He had lived in Indonesia, Barack Obama did. And here was Michelle Robinson anchored in the South Side of Chicago, anchored in the American Black experience.
So he was attracted to this, this strong, well-knit family. What did they think of him?
Well, it's funny. At first, Michelle's mother was a little concerned when it seemed that they were serious. She told an interviewer, Marian Robinson did in 2004, that she was a little worried because Barack had a white mother. She thought that might be a bit of a problem for their prospective children, might be a complicating factor. She quickly recovered from that and actually came to quite adore him. And one of the interesting things that Barack Obama has said is that the role model, when he thinks of a role model as a father for his own kids, he thinks about Michelle's father.
That man was, he knew that man much better than his own dad. He was there at his funeral.
That's right. He spent some time with Frazier Robinson, and Frazier Robinson died young. He was 55 years old when he died of complications from multiple sclerosis. This was 3 years after, 2 or 3 years, I guess, after Barack and Michelle had met. And Frazier Robinson made a very big impression on Barack Obama.
Let's talk about where Michelle Robinson's, this is still Michelle Robinson, they haven't got married yet, where her career went after she had a moment of reckoning and decided that this corporate law firm was, she had had enough of an experience there. And where did she go from there?
Well, that's right. Several things happened in very short order to compel Michelle Robinson to leave Sidley and Austin. And one of the most important was the death of her Princeton friend, Suzanne Alele, at age 25, quite unexpectedly. She developed a very severe form of cancer and serious form of cancer and died young. And Michelle looked at her own life and said, boy, if I die tomorrow, is this how I would want to be remembered? Is this what is making me happy every day? And the answer was no. And so she looked around to try to figure out what would be satisfying, what would feel a little bit more meaningful. And she sent a letter around to City Hall. This is Richard M. Daley's City Hall. She didn't want to be a lawyer, and that was clear, even though she could have been hired in a heartbeat as a lawyer. And so Susan Schur, who at that time was in the legal office at City Hall, passed Michelle's application to one Valerie Jarrett, whom we know now as a senior counselor in the White House. Valerie Jarrett saw this resume of Michelle Robinson and immediately wanted to interview her.
So she got the job. She took a 50% salary cut and went to work for the mayor.
She did. She worked in City Hall for the mayor in the mayor's office. Interestingly enough, Michelle said before accepting the job, she asked Valerie Jarrett if Valerie would be willing to meet her fiance, Barack Obama, and talk things over. And so you have this moment where Valerie Jarrett, then all of 34 years old, and Barack just turning 30, and Michelle 27, get together at a Chicago restaurant to talk about whether Michelle could do good work in City Hall.
You know, you can't write a biography of Michelle Obama without talking about, when they got hitched. Talk about, how he proposed, when this happened, and, how the marriage happened.
There's a wonderful story that Barack Obama tells about how they've been dating for a while. Michelle wanted to get serious. To her, serious meant marriage. Barack saying, oh, gosh, marriage, a certificate. Who needs the piece of paper? How could that possibly matter? Knowing probably pretty well that in Michelle Obama's book, marriage mattered. In fact, she later said marriage was everything. And so one day they're going out for a pretty fancy dinner. Barack had been studying for the Illinois bar examination. They're celebrating, and as he describes it, she's haranguing him over dinner about this refusal to commit. And he has already arranged with the waiter so that when the dessert came, with the dessert was an engagement ring. And he says to her, well, that pretty much shut you up, didn't it?
Class act. It's interesting, the territory that you get into in this book when it comes to, the early years of their marriage, and then they end up with one and then two children, and Michelle Obama, is essentially the breadwinner for the family, while we've got this husband who's sort of jetting off on this long commute to try to start a political career. Talk about that chapter.
Michelle moved from City Hall to a young people's training program that she ran. She really created from scratch in Chicago called Public Allies. She said it was the most meaningful, most important, most satisfying work she had ever done. She was building this organization, and Barack was still trying to find his way. He certainly wasn't penniless. He was teaching constitutional law at the University of Chicago. He was working for a boutique law firm on some important progressive legal matters, including voting rights. And then in 1995, he decides he's going to run for the Illinois State Senate. So he's got these competing professions in a way that were very, very demanding on his time. By 2001, they had two children. They had Malia, who was born in 1998, and Sasha, born in June 2001. And Michelle was feeling that she was getting kind of the short straw in terms of how their lives were run at home. She felt that Barack, and she's talked about this, Barack was not home enough. She was running the household as well as, at this point, having a job at the University of Chicago where she was working on a community service program.
Peter, we're going to take a quick break here, but our conversation will continue shortly. We'll get into sort of the present tense here with Michelle Obama as First Lady, what she's accomplishing, what maybe she's holding back, and what the future may have in store for her. Listeners, you're welcome to join us, 410-662-8780. Midday, we'll be right back. You're tuned to Midday here on WYPR. I'm Aaron Henkin, in today for Dan Rodericks. And listeners, we welcome your voice here in this conversation with Peter Slevin, author of Michelle Obama, A Life. Join us live on the air here at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Your thoughts about the First Lady, her path, her priorities, her accomplishments, things she's done wonderfully, things she could have done better so far. How much is she holding back at this point, and what could be next for her in the years after her husband's presidency? Your thoughts are welcome, 410-662-8780. And Peter Slevin, let's fast forward here to when Barack Obama is finally elected president. Michelle is actually First Lady and now has to do all these things First Ladies are supposed to do. How did she react? I mean, how do you react to a job like that? Was she a natural? Did she make mistakes at first?
What a strange existence it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Here she comes from a 20-year professional career on the south side of Chicago, 10 years as a working mom, driving the carpool, working down the block from her job, very much her own independent identity. And suddenly she's in Washington, and her identity is fully connected to that of her husband. What a strange life that she has suddenly inherited, and she really has to invent herself. Her friends and her staff said it was a very tough transition. You know, you think about Laura Bush, for example, you think about Hillary Clinton. They had lived in the governor's mansion in their respective states. Mm-hmm. They knew about life in the public eye. But for Michelle, it was a very new thing.
I'll take a break here and let some of our listeners get in on the conversation. Let me go to the phones here and welcome Brian from Pasadena to the conversation. Brian, you're on the air with Peter Slevin.
Hi, Peter. My name is Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
Nice to hear from you, Brian.
My question concerns her Let's Move campaign based on more exercise as a key to solving obesity. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I was just curious. In 2009, her emphasis was more on healthy eating. And I was just wondering if you could explain the change in emphasis from her garden that she planted in 2009 and now her emphasis on exercise. But in reality, everyone knows that exercise alone will not cure obesity. It's, you know, what you're eating.
Brian, go ahead. Finish up, and we'll go ahead and let Peter answer that question.
Okay, I was just saying that her emphasis has changed from healthy eating to exercise, but exercise alone will never solve the obesity problem. Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Brian. So, Peter, you hear a caller saying, you know, we've got a first lady who's chosen healthy eating. She's choosing exercise. What is it about the initiatives she chooses and the calculus that goes into them?
Well, I think first, in response to Brian's question, in fact, she sees it all as part of the same effort, the same ambition to change eating habits and exercise habits, which is why she's fought so hard and so publicly to defend the nutrition standards passed by Congress in 2010. More broadly, I think one can look at her nutrition efforts and her mentoring, her efforts on something called Reach Higher, which is to encourage disadvantaged kids to get further training and schooling after high school, and even her military family's effort as a way to focus on people who in this country who may not have a strong voice, who are in many ways disadvantaged. If you think about the nutrition issue in particular, obviously her efforts on the school lunch programs get a great deal of attention with a hashtag, gee, thanks, Michelle Obama, implying that the food tastes terrible. But if you think about who that's for, who buys school lunches, in fact, 70% of the meals purchased in public schools each day by American kids are by kids who can't afford to pay full fare, full freight. And so her nutrition efforts are targeted in an important way toward the kids who need it most. And I think the fitness program is valuable for everybody.
Peter, I'm going to head to the phones here again in just a minute, but let me just interject here and observe you and tell me whether or not this is a valid observation or not. But when you are the first African-American first lady, you have to walk a tightrope that is more precarious than any other first lady, in the sense that whatever initiatives you do choose are going to be scrutinized to a level never before scrutinized. And so it appears that Michelle Obama is almost sort of doing things in a sort of symbolic coded way, where an initiative may appear very, generic or bland, but if you look under the surface, there's a bit, perhaps a subtext to be inferred. And that might have to do something as well with, you know, the fact that she's had to learn to hold her tongue. For the betterment of her, or the preservation of her husband's political career.
It's a very difficult role, isn't it, Aaron, for anyone who is first lady. After all, the first lady has no playbook, has no constitutional authority, has no salary, and has a pretty small staff. And so it's a constant challenge to try to do something purposeful and meaningful and, you could say, palatable in a country where there are just such an extraordinary array of views of what that role should be. And Michelle has felt it from the left as well as from the right. And there is absolutely an added burden being the first African-American first lady. When you think of the criticism that she got during the first campaign and criticism that she's heard since then, that is simply undeniably connected in some cases to her race.
Let's talk, Peter, about a subject that I'm getting lots of emails about here, and that is, of course, Michelle Obama's fashion sense. I guess this matters, and this is a big deal. She is the best thing to happen fashion-wise, as far as First Ladies go, since Jackie Kennedy. I'll let you expound on that.
Sure. I certainly wrote some about this in the book. I mean, the fashion world in America loves Michelle Obama, the fashion trade. She simply, as her friends and her staff say, she delights in clothes. She sees clothes as making a statement, certainly, about style as well as substance. But she also gets a great deal of enjoyment out of it. And I spoke with designers who have worked with her, who find that she is trying to convey that you can choose clothes that make you feel comfortable, that you don't have to conform to some certain mold. And while the comparison is so often drawn with Jackie Kennedy from 50 years ago, there's much more of a common approach to some of Michelle's clothes, too, where she will quite carefully choose accessories off the rack or designs off the rack that are much more affordable to average Americans than perhaps some of the clothes that, let's say, Chanel that Jackie Kennedy preferred.
You're tuned to Midday. Aaron Henkin here, in for Dan Rodericks. We're talking with Peter Slevin. He's the biographer. He's the author of this new biography, Michelle Obama, A Life. And Peter, on to perhaps a more substantive topic here. Let's talk about the First Lady's job as a mom. She has really been engaged in raising her two daughters in the White House. And, you know, frankly, they seem like, no offense to the children of other presidents, but they seem like the least crazy, you know, presidential children that we've had in a long time.
She emphasizes this role. You know, you'll remember, Aaron, that when she first got to the White House in 2009, her staff called her the mom in chief, and she later picked that up. And in a way, that bought her some time. It was a bit of a buffer. She was saying that I need to get Malia and Sasha settled before I can really focus on my agenda. Some people saw it, too, as a bit of a political dodge, where she was trying to do things that something that felt safe. In fact, and she reiterated this in her Tuskegee University speech the other Saturday, she sees being Malia and Sasha's mom as her most important role. Her view is that her daughters, they have brought their daughters into this quite unusual, to put it mildly, fishbowl that they inhabit, and that it is incumbent on Barack and Michelle Obama to do what they can to make it, at least their lives, at least somewhat normal.
And I guess in a way it comes back around full circle to her own childhood and the importance of having a mom and a dad who were there and who played board games with them on every Saturday night. And yeah, a mom who forsook being someone with a second career in the family to be a stay-at-home mom.
Yes, that is right. Michelle, in fact, said that her first ambition was to be a mom before she really thought of a career. She said when she was growing up and where she was growing up, she didn't think of becoming, an astronaut or a doctor. That kind of an idea came later, and that deep down she wants to be, a good and worthy mother. She has, she'll say to Sasha and Malia that, you need to learn to do your own laundry before you get to college. You need to pick up after you. She would tell the White House staff not to make their beds. When it came to sports, which is very important in the Obama household, as it was in the Robinson household, she wanted each girl to play two sports, one sport that each girl chose and one sport that Michelle chose, because she explained she wanted them to learn to be good at something they did not choose.
That's sort of the story of her life, isn't it? Learning to be good at something she didn't choose.
It's interesting. Barack Obama has said that he wants both girls to have minimum wage jobs to understand that while, of course, the Obama kids can probably be anything they choose to be, that is not the case for an awful lot of people in this country.
I have a question here from a listener who emails Michelle. She writes, what role do you see for Mrs. Obama in the future? Do you ever see her taking a role as a public servant, perhaps a cabinet member, or even a presidential candidate?
I'll defer to Barack Obama on the question of Michelle entering politics. He was asked, it was posed to him not too long ago by an interviewer. So imagine you heard in 10 years from now that Michelle was in politics. And he said, well, I would assume at that moment that she had been abducted by aliens, but politics is probably not the way she's going to go. But Michelle has made it very clear that she intends to be involved in public life and public policy. She'll be doing some writing. She has said she wants to continue to focus on education, which she describes as the most important civil rights challenge of our time.
How much of a different Michelle Obama do you think we're going to be treated to as the American public after the stakes of her husband's, you know, presidential polling numbers and, you know, ups and downs? Once she's got a little bit more latitude to speak her mind and follow her own path, I mean, are we going to sort of see a Michelle Obama sort of reemerging out of a shell into sort of a new entity?
I think that's an absolutely intriguing question, and I would love to know the answer myself. I think if we chart how Michelle Obama has evolved into this role as First Lady, we are seeing in the second term, and again, it's very clear in the Tuskegee University speech, a woman who is increasingly comfortable speaking truth to power, which is how she used to put it in the first campaign, doing some truth-telling about what is happening in this society. She talks about race, she talks about class, she talks about gender inequality. I think we don't have to look very far beneath the surface of her current statements, and this has been true throughout, to see what it is she's thinking and where she thinks this country needs to go if the deck is to be unstacked.
Peter Slevin, do you think any word whether or not Michelle Obama has read this book of yours, this biography?
I know she has a copy, and I do not know whether she's read it.
Here's a question for you. Would you be more interested in writing a biography about whoever the next First Lady happens to be, or writing a biography about the next chapter of Michelle Obama's life?
I'm still intrigued to see where Michelle Obama is going to go from here. She has such an important voice, and she knows it. And I feel very convinced that she will be using it. And I certainly would like to keep following her story. You know, I wrote this book not as a First Lady book or even as a politics book, but as a true biography of a woman with a remarkable trajectory and a woman whose story really is not yet fully finished. She'll only be 53 when she leaves the White House in 2017. She has a lot left to say and to do.
Peter Slevin, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you. Peter Slevin is the author of Michelle Obama, A Life. The biography is available. You pronounce the publisher, Peter.
Knopf.
I always get that wrong. Knopf? Knopf.
Knopf, okay. I suppose.
Michelle Obama, A Life. The author, Peter Slevin. Peter, thanks so much for being with us.
A real pleasure. Thanks so much, Aaron.
All right. For Dan Rodericks, I'm Aaron Henkin. Thanks for joining us this week and today on Midday.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Aaron Morenzi, Alexis Kuhn, and Aaliyah Satterfield. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.